Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about gridless. Gridless is not an unknown player in the Bitcoin mining industry. I've had Janet Maingi before on the show, before it was on YouTube. Today I'm speaking to Eric, CEO of Gridless, to talk about the fifth epoch, the industry, how he sees it going forward. He's a good friend, business partner of mine, so I'm not very impartial here. I hope you can forgive me and still tell me, you know, any questions you have, any pointers you have. Enjoy the show and let me know what other questions I should have asked. Cheers. All right, guys. So like I said in the brief introduction, I'm here joined today by my friend Eric Hirstman, CEO of Gridless. We've interviewed Janet before on the podcast, but that was before YouTube. So welcome, Eric, to the show.
Hey, thanks, Jesse. Good to be here.
We're going to speak about Gridless, where you guys are today. Gamma, also the Green Africa Mining Alliance, the fifth epoch that we just found ourselves in after the official halving, after the halving has now officially begun, it feels like, looking at hash price. We are at block height 840924. Our 14-day hash rate is at 643 exahashes, keeps going up, and the hash price has now come down from recent runes-induced heights, I would say, to 5727, and we just visited all-time lows, I think, in the 56 region, which is, now it's starting to really get a bit uncomfortable for all of those S19s hosted in America at 7.2 cents or whatever. So it's going to be interesting where the dynamics go. How do you look at this, Eric? Where do you get a bit nervous looking at your revenues? Or do you not even look at it?
We have a little different view on it, right? Because most of our deals are revenue share. We don't have a base floor price on a lot of what we do, which means that we have a little bit more elasticity that we can play with in what happens with either the Bitcoin price, the hash price, and like everybody knows, the most expensive part of running a mining operation is your power bill. And so, you know, if that's something that you can, you can do with a rev share instead of, putting out, whatever it is, 4 cents, 6 cents, 8 cents, whatever people have been paying, then you decrease your risk, right? That's really what it is. So we know that in a down market, when things get really bad for mining, when the water is really low, that we can keep swimming, right? Because we have a revenue share agreement with the power partner. And what that does for us, though, too, and it does decrease our upside, though, right? So like the upside is reduced because if we're giving away typically around, somewhere between 25 to maybe 30%, that percentage then is taken off the top as well. So it does decrease the top side, but we think that the better part of this whole setup is that we are de-risked over the coming years when there's a lot of, sometimes volatility in that hash price or in the price of Bitcoin as a whole, and we don't have to deal with it the same way as everybody else.
I think we will see that what you just described a lot more in the hosting model as well. I just put out some post on LinkedIn talking about profit splits, because there's actually right now, hosting going on in the US and people looking for people to deploy ASICs in a similar fashion, where you set the base floor price, so it's not exactly like what you described, lower, you put power pass-throughs on these agreements, I don't know, call it 4 to 5 cents. And then you split depending on what model of ASIC you deploy. And it does exactly that, protects you to the downside, mm-hmm. incentivizes the hoster in that moment to operate your machines more efficiently, right? Because 20% of the net profits goes to them. So they're now incentivized to keep it running. Do you see something similar where now the energy provider is interested in keeping your access to electricity as stable when they do have stranded capacity available?
Well, I mean, our situation might be a little bit different than, most of the people who are doing mining in the developed world anyway, which is that we're working in rural areas of Africa that have very significant stranded energy problems. So they have there's a power site there, some hydro has been built, a biomass, a geothermal, whatever it is. And they have a certain uptake already, and that's not going to grow or diminish too quickly, right? It's mostly going to stay around this 20 to 30% volume of their power that they have. So when we're dealing with it, you know, we're coming in, we're saying, we are your buyer of last resort on this site, which means that everybody else comes first. So if you ever have another partner, it could be, you know, a factory, it could be a mobile phone tower, it could be just more people in the community getting electricity to their homes. Any of those kind of things beat us, right? And so we expect to be turned off during those times. And we built our contract with them around that very specific demand on their side. Because part of what our mission is with Gridless is helping to push electrification of Africa further to the edges. How can we make sure that more people get electricity by using Bitcoin mining as an anchor tenant on these stranded energy sites? So that means that by default, we expect to be turned off, where a lot of other people around the world, in the Bitcoin mining world especially, are doing everything they can not to be turned off. We realize that it's part of our job to be turned off. So that means, I mean, we come at that with a very different lens. And so when you start looking at it from a different lens, you do different things. So for instance, you know, we like to have a mixture of machines on site where you can have some high efficiency machines and some lower efficiency machines. So a blend, and that blend allows you to turn off the lower efficiency machines first and then keep the higher efficiency machines running the whole time. It also means that we have to be very, very careful and specific about how, you know, like, well, of course, we don't want to be turned off either in some ways. Like we always like, we want to use as much power as is available every time. So what that means for us is we've had to build software that allows us to tap into the WhatsMiner API, because that's WhatsMiner is the only mining ASIC that we use. And
this is sponsored.
And
by...
No, I'm joking. No, yeah, it's not. But really, you know, we've looked at other ones, we've tried other ones, and WhatsMiner keeps on ticking when every other miner breaks down. And what that means is our software, Gridless OS, allows us to manage these energy sites and the mining in them very granularly. So we can turn off, you know, in sub 1 second in order for somebody to turn their lights on at their home or a maize mill to be turned on or whatever it is. But it also means that we want to keep things a little bit running in the background so that we can ramp back up as soon as they also turn off, so that we can use every little bit of energy that we can inside of that ecosystem of energy that we're plugged into. So the ways we manage that are different than others, but you know, I think they're going to be more common for more miners going forward too.
Yeah, briefly, because I already have so many detailed questions and we haven't even covered the basics. I was always under the conviction that the ramping up, especially, I mean, turning off is easy, right? Reducing power draw to zero is easy, but maybe staying at 100 watts is less so. I was always under the impression that it is hardware restrictions that keep you from ramping up quickly. Because if you look at like the recent auto-tune videos from Auradine, for instance, it takes a while, you know, until the ASIC has reached the full exact 180 terahash, for instance. So can you explain a bit about how Gridless OS does that, or is that proprietary? Or did you release, I think you released the software also, didn't you?
No, we haven't released the software. It just feels too early for that. So the way we do it with Gridless OS, and we've been, you're right, it is a hardware thing that we have to work with. And most of the ASICs do not allow you to play with the control board in enough detail to be able to manage this. And you're always going to have a slower ramp up than you have a shutdown, right? So let's just acknowledge that's always going to be the case. But you can have a quicker ramp up than currently is able to be done. But to do that, you have to be able to talk to and control the control board. And so what we've been doing is we're still going through a lot of testing on this, but we're playing with a third-party control board that we can replace on our miners that will allow us to have that granular control. And I think that's where things get interesting. And this is also why we're, you know, yes, they're one of our investors, but we're also very big proponents of it, of what Block is doing with open sourcing a new hardware ASIC and all of the peripherals around it. Because quite frankly, the current state of mining requires a lot more control to deal with efficiencies and up and down times, stranded power versus, you know, high demand power. All these things are important. And if the miners can't control the environment that they're running in, then that actually is harmful for both the energy company and the other users on that grid. And so we need, and harmful for the miner itself, right? So like, it's not good for anybody. So we need more granular control of these things. And the ASIC manufacturers haven't wanted to give it. In fact, they've been obfuscating it and trying to hide that ability to control it. So that leaves the door open for third-party providers to, you know, build different control boards. And that gives us control. Or B, in the case of Block, build a whole new miner, a whole new ASIC. And then you can have even more control. And then you open source the hardware as well, which is what they're doing. And you're gonna see a lot more innovation coming from the space in the coming years as that becomes more and more available. So like what people are doing with the BitAx, at the very small level of, you know, people using 110 power in homes and figuring out if they can put a BitAx between their washing machine and their power outlet in their home is super interesting. And the innovation happening even in that kind of home mining, pleb mining space is, I think, some of the most interesting stuff happening in mining. That is just a small microcosm of what will come to larger mining setups. So we're not large miners. We're small miners, right? But the small, medium, and even large size miners are going to get a lot more interesting in the coming years as that control gets passed from the manufacturer to the miner themselves.
I'm fully with you. I think it happens on a small scale first. You're not a big, you know, large mega farm miner, yes, but you use regular ASICs. And therefore you're exposed to the shenanigans of the Bitmains and MicroBTs and Canaans of the world. I mean, you know, you say they're obfuscating it, but Bitmain is now actively going against the use of third-party software with the recent news that they put out about not being able to use third-party software at all. And it leaves, as you said, the door wide open for people like, or for companies like Auradine to come in and completely disrupt the market and, you know, induce competition into this, which is highly necessary. I fully agree. But yeah, it also makes it
And Jesse, there's a couple other mine, you know, people making ASICs as well. There's what Auradine is doing. I'm going to blank on the other names, but there's what Block is doing, which is different than everybody else, is open sourcing the hardware of the miner itself, which is, it's very, very important, I think, for Bitcoin. But there's a couple other manufacturers that are coming out with their own chips as well. So I think we're going to see increased competition. The question is, of those large of these new manufacturers, which ones have the staying power? So a really important part of Bitcoin mining is like, are you going to be able to get parts? Are you going to be able to fix this? Can you call somebody and get some customer service? And you don't just need this for when it's launched. I need this 3 to 5 years from now. And so like looking at the longevity of these organizations and their ability to not just manufacture, but be an operating company is super important, right? And so, you know, I'm sure that some of them will not make it. You know, that's what always happens. But we will see this injection of innovation along, but, you know, who actually survives is also going to be an interesting thing for all of us who are trying to buy their equipment.
It just feels like up until now, all the innovation happened on the ASIC nanometer level. Like, how small can I make it? How much hash rate can I push out of it? But as you sort of approach that limit of what's physically possible, you now see competition in who's got the better service, who's got the better control board, who's got the better repair services, which ones are more available. Because at the end of the day, and I tell this to customers all the time, what happens is, what's important is what happens on the rack. Like once the machine is in the rack, that's what matters, not what efficiency it has on paper. You know what I mean? So over the next 2 to 3 years, how efficient is the machine really? how often do you have to send it a repair service that's not available? So
that's like efficiency is more than a product of just, efficiency is more than a product of just, you know, it's this many joules per terahash, right? It's also how often is it running? And which is a big thing, right? Like, you know, I've got teams in the field on three sites right now dealing with, you know, just repairs and maintenance and things, you know, like you do every day. And, you know, that's a, you know, when you're operating in East Africa, you have to be able to do all that yourself. You're not going to ship these off to somebody in China or the US or Europe because the cost of that doesn't make sense and the time doesn't make sense. So you've got to actually build the muscle to do those things on your own. And so that's something that, you know, fortunately we come from a hardware and technology and engineering background. So we have some of the people in our bubble that can do those kind of things, but we've actually had to bring in even more experienced electrical engineers, to make sure that we can do these repairs properly.
This is what's going to be my next question. And again, we have to go back to basics. We're already a couple of minutes in here, but it's super interesting. How do you handle that? Like, do you have a local repair center in Nairobi or in any of the major, you know, cities that in the countries that you operate in, or do you do this all on site? And there's a sort of tech bench that comes with every site that you go to. How do you handle this?
So the way we're handling it is, you know, of course, Nairobi being our main office is everybody pretty much HQs out of here. And this is where everybody gets trained up and learns how to fix things. But we've made a requirement that any of our field teams have to be able to fix it to a certain level, any miner. Now, once you get to needing a reflow oven to do something with your board, there's, you know, things change a little bit. So we have to centralize that. But generally speaking, anytime somebody goes to the field, they go with a field repair kit. And that means if they find something there, they can replace or repair it. And gives us, you know, again, more efficiency, more uptime. So it's something that we were okay at last year, and we've had to really get good at this year. Just that repair, that maintenance, that support. It's like infrastructure on its own is kind of boring for most people. Mining is infrastructure, right? And repair and maintenance, like, is there anything that's more of a snooze fest to listen to? Usually not. I mean, that is kind of boring stuff. Like, you know, my eyes might glaze over if we talk about it for too long, right? But it's important stuff, right? This is actually what people forget about mining, I think, a lot of the times, is it's an efficiency game as a company. Your whole job is to run money printers as inexpensively as possible or as efficiently as possible, right? So that means that, you know, all those little details about how operationally efficient you are, how operationally proficient you are at repairing, those kind of things matter a whole lot. And, fortunately there's been those who have gone before us. So, you know, we've been on calls with, you know, the Maras and the Crusoes and the other large miners of the US and Europe as well. And what's been interesting is finding out how many of them had to build the muscle to do their maintenance, repairs and support as well. And they learned all these lessons. So, you know, it made it an easier decision strategically as a company. First of all, we just have to look at our reality of being kind of off here in East Africa on our own. And then second, just saying, oh, okay, listen, everybody else who's gotten really good at this has seen some major gains from it. So let's get good at this.
It's the blue collar aspect of Bitcoin mining that at the end of the day is really necessary as a foundation, so we can sit here and talk and record podcasts all day.
I don't know if there's a white collar part of Bitcoin mining unless you go public and you're just out there on.
I think there is.
You know, raising money the whole time.
Yeah, going to a lot of events. You know, having fancy dinners. I think there's a lot of that also. Eric, let's talk a bit more basics. Where are you guys today from where you started? How many sites do you operate? Where do you operate them? Then I have a few more questions around that.
Yeah, so I mean, we've been operating for almost two years now, not quite. And we have six sites in three countries. So we have you know, a couple in Kenya. We've got one in Zambia, one in Malawi. We're expanding in all the countries over the coming next 12 months as well. A lot of what we do is hydro. Hydro is maybe one of the most interesting renewable energy types in Africa because they last so long, right? You can definitely deploy solar faster, maybe even wind, but you know, with hydro, you get longevity. You get 30, 50 years of this hydro site being there. And so the economics of that look really good for people. And that's been the case for over 100 years on the continent. We see some hydros that have been there for 80 years and still run, or maybe just need a little bit of maintenance to get running again. And that's really interesting, right? So a lot of what we do is in hydro, but we also have a biomass site we've been working on it for the past couple of weeks. It's a really interesting site. Uses waste sisal, so that's the plant that they make textiles, rope, and different types of thread from, and it's fairly prevalent across East Africa. So we work with a group that has a large plantation of sisal and the community around it. And then we also have a geothermal site where they had some stranded power. And that one's actually interesting because the geothermal one, for whatever reason, they had mixed with another megawatt of solar. So we'd always tried to see if we could make solar work, because solar is the fastest type of energy you can put out in Africa. And it takes the least amount of work to get out there. It takes the least amount of infrastructure to put in place, right? Like the civil works are minimal compared to anything else. But listen, with, you know, 8 hours a day of sunlight, the economics just don't make sense. You know, you've got to put in, you know, a very high capital cost on the battery storage if you want to make it work. And then it still doesn't have a great amount of time that it can be running. So anyway, long story short, we've been able to see firsthand what it looks like to have a full megawatt of solar at your disposal and how much energy is actually available from it. And, you know, without getting into great detail, I just say we're not impressed. And we'd love for solar to work, but we don't see how it can right now. Unless battery storage changes significantly in cost, we don't see how that can work. So anyway, back to your original question, six sites, yep. Three countries, a couple of different types of energy.
Yeah, just on that solar bit, I just went on a podcast here in South Africa to talk about, you know, mining with stranded solar. And when people ask me about mining with solar, I always two answers. Like it depends. You know, there's one approach where you build solar and batteries to mine Bitcoin, which makes no sense at all, in my opinion, right now, right? Without having any experience, but just looking at the numbers. But the second bit is, if the solar is already there and unused, then it's free power, right? So it's about the approach. And if you can couple it with, I don't know, old M20s that cost nothing and the shipment is cheap, then yes, okay. But otherwise,
if you're using old miners, look at all the factors. If you're using old miners that are virtually free anyway, then your return on investment is also negligible. So it doesn't, it doesn't make as much of a difference. Yeah. Sure. You might as well just get a few, you know, you can hash some sats, you know, during the time that you have power, and you don't have to really care about it if it's not hashing. Right. There's that. But if you're running mining as a business rather than mining as an addendum to your business, I think, or an auxiliary to your business, then it's different.
Yeah. Okay, so with those sites in mind, what is sort of the, you mentioned revenue splits, what sort of range of revenue split do you guys usually get into? What are your thoughts around return on investment of these machines? You know, what does uptime look like, and your corresponding choice in ASIC as well? Where are you on that?
Sure. So we think about it. So our return on investment, we're like everybody else. Our desire is to have, you know, like an 18-month play, you know, return on investment for a site. Realistically, we're dependent on the hash rate. as well in our own efficiency and making sure those things are running. We tend to use, like I said earlier, we only use WhatsMiner right now. And we tend to use M30s to M50s. And, you know, they're great machines. You know, they work really well in our environment where, you know, it can either, we have to watch out for temperature, dust, bugs, things like that, that might get into the system. You know, like I've told this story before, but like there's a time when we didn't have the filter on the side of the container yet. And so when the rainy season came, we get these things called flying ants that come up, these bugs. And so somebody had left on the light inside the container, and they always fly towards the light. And the next day we're looking like, what happened to our hash rate? And we go to find out, and we just got bug guts just gumming up everything in these WhatsMiners, right? And they're still hashing though, just not very well. They're really about to die, right? And so what had happened was that thousands and thousands of these bugs had been drawn towards the light and sucked in through the, you know, in the fans and each miner. And it was just a mess. It took us like, you know, 2 to 3 days with toothbrushes to clean off everything and got it running again. Right. Yeah. So that's, you know, it's one of the reasons we like WhatsMiners, because they just keep working, and that's what we need.
When, if you hadn't shared that story, I would have asked you to please share it with my audience, because this is literally the story I tell folks when they ask me why in Africa people like MicroBT so much. Because the fact of the matter is, bug guts are not very good coolants, and yeah, it's insane that they still hashed, right? And it's not like, oh, all our miners are off. No, it's they reduced inefficiency, which is hilarious.
Yeah, so I mean, you're dealing with those kind of environmental things, right? Where you've got this. You got bugs or you've got dust. You know, we've got, you know, there's some sites that are in very green areas that don't have a lot of dust, because they're kind of just, they're the highlands. But then there's other sites that are not in the highlands. They're in a dusty area. And like, I remember when we first set up in Zambia, the wind that would come down, just pick up all this dust and just drive it directly into our container. Right. So you're sitting in this dust bowl and you're trying to like, okay, the efficiencies of these miners over time is going to be limited if they have all this dust inside. So we have to have filters on it. And we were, you know, this is our first mining container we had built. We build our own mining containers from scratch, right? For cost reasons. And man, it was messy. We had to, you know, we didn't quite have the brackets right. So we had to, we're sitting there in the middle of nowhere in Zambia. Like, we are 12 hours from the closest airport. Right, like 12-hour drive. So you are way out there, and the closest place where you can buy groceries is about 4 hours away. You know, so you're not close to stores that, you know, you can go out and just buy something and put it in. So you're working with what you have, and so we're sitting out there trying to figure out how we're going to frame these things properly and just building them there next to the mining container. Eventually, we got it sorted out, but we had to actually get a local. A guy with a local sewing machine to help us sew the filter material together in a way to fit these wooden frames that we built on the side of the container. And, you know, it's just like, you just kind of got to make things work. That filter was not great, you know, it worked and it helped us for that first couple of weeks. And then we went back down and with the proper materials and the proper, equipment and fixed it properly itself. But yeah, those are the kind of things you have to deal with. And it's great when you're working with a type of miner that can handle those, you know, those kind of things that Africa throws at you.
Yeah, it's forgiving. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I mean, you already talked about using different types of models. What is, how much stranded capacity is there on the average site? Like, how much time during the year do you see your machines running? Is it more like 20%, more like 75%? Is it 95%? Because there's a constant stream of water, for instance, at a hydro site that's always available and never used.
Yeah, so it does differ on the type of energy, because you know, in Africa we have rainy and dry seasons. In East Africa, we have two rainy seasons. We're going through one right now. And but in Southern Africa, we found it's more like a single rainy season that affects everything. So Malawi and Zambia are a little bit different than Kenya. Typically speaking, there's two ways that you can see the efficiency. One is how much energy is used by the community first. So how much stranded energy is actually available? Typically that's around, like the highest we've ever seen is 36% usage by ordinary customers. And that leaves us, I guess 62%, 64%, somewhere around there that we could use. But then you have to deal with, then you add on to that, dry season where the water levels go down and you're maybe running at 40 or 50% capacity. And so that means that if we look at our kind of delta over time, it does fluctuate throughout the year. I would say that we expect to see about 50 to 70% usage of our miners on any site, which has led us to a new strategy on this at a country level. It only works if you have more than one site. But so in Kenya right now, what we're doing is we're creating a hub, which is a slightly larger mining site that has more power available all the time. So generally for us, that would not be hydro. Then that would be biomass or geothermal, something that has consistent energy all the time. And then that serves as a hub so that during the dry season, we can take machines that aren't being utilized at the hydro sites, move them to the hub. And then in the rainy season or before the rainy season, move them back out and just plug them back in.
And it's worth the extra cost? That's very smart.
I mean, the extra cost is a pickup truck of, 20 miners, that are being taken from one site to another, which are, 2 hours away. So yeah, it's not a problem for us on that. And you're doing that twice a year. It's the numbers work out for us.
But how does that make sense? Because theoretically at that hub, you could also just mine with all the slots all the time. Why would you keep them? How does it make sense to keep them open?
Well, you have to remember something. We are not we're not one of your average miners, right? Part of our mission, as I said in the beginning, is to help push electrification further to the edges in Africa. And that means that we work very closely strategically with our energy partners to make sure that they can make things work. So yes, I want to have all my miners running all the time if possible, but I do need to make sure that we honor the mission that we're on as well, which is making sure that the power companies are able to make a profit and work. So if that means that I have to take a little bit of a hit on some of that efficiency during the year at a hub site, that is worth it to me. Just because I know that it makes it viable, and it makes it, of course, we're going to make it viable for that energy partner anyway. What this actually does is it gives me more upside rather than just having my miners sit idle at that hydro site in rural Zambia or rural Kenya.
Yeah, it also gives you a bit of protection, against a change of mind or whatever. Or what if the communities grow all of a sudden, there's 300
which we expect them to
load because some industrial customer comes online, and then you can move them.
Yeah, no, we absolutely expect them to change. We expect it to change. Like if you're running an energy site and you can get a tea factory to start using your power, that might be an extra 50 kilowatts. But they're going to pay you 10 cents, 12 cents a kilowatt for that energy. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas the Bitcoin mining, even with the rev share position we have, if you did the quick math on it, it might be, if they were to cash it out immediately, it ranges between like 2 and 4 cents, right? That they might get paid. And, of course you should take that, that's what's economically better for you. And so we recognize that. And we build, like I said earlier, we build our agreements with them around that eventuality. And so that does mean that over time, we should be putting ourselves out of some business in any one site. Now, the truth is, there's no site that is 100% efficiency and 100% uptime, period. There is not a single one. And so, we'll always have some miners
HPC
there.
AI data centers. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Understood. So anyway, I think there's something interesting in that space And, you know, there might be something we can do over time to make even those hubs more efficient. But at first, it's just about getting something set up to make ourselves as a business more strategically viable. But this breaks into another thing that I think is super interesting, which is, you know, we've been, and I know you want to talk about this, so I'm just going to bridge it anyway. So don't mind me, Jesse, which is like the energy itself, right? Why is it that there's so many, you know, the numbers are 500 to 600 million people in Africa do not have any electricity at all. Why is that the case? And you start looking into the numbers and you realize that, you know, the main national grids have gone about as far as they will. And by the way, there's a whole conversation to be had on distribution. Like we just saw the news this week of Tanzania turning off, you know, their 2-gigawatt dam because they don't have the distribution organized, right? So they have energy, but they don't have anywhere to put it. And they don't, and they don't even have the cables.
It's painful.
They don't have the distribution right. Well, the same thing's happened in Ethiopia, right? So they're building this, you know, the massive dam there. And the reason why there's so many Bitcoin miners are coming in is even in a country with 100 million plus population like Ethiopia, where there's vast numbers of people who don't have electricity, it actually isn't worth the investment by the national government yet. And they'll do it over time, but to build the grid deeper into those edge spaces, because you have small populations actually in large plots of land, so that the density isn't there for the usage, and so they know their return on investment isn't going to be good enough. Okay, so small digression into national grids and power generation in Africa is typically not the problem. Power distribution is the problem, and we don't have good grid interconnects. We don't have all these things that people expect in Europe or the US or even Asia. So it's a very different, you know, ecosystem. So what does make sense, though, is these smaller independent power producers who are going in and building mini grids. So they're building small energy sites, you know, typically, you know, let's say under 2 megawatts. And they're trying to, you know, just serve a local community and the businesses that might or might not be in that area yet. And so we looked at that and I was like, why are there not more of these? You know, and this is my whole journey over the last year and a half. It's like, why? I don't understand why there's not more energy. And unlike you, I didn't come from the energy side. So I was like, what the hell's going on here? And sometimes it's interesting coming in with a fresh lens, not being from an industry, because you can ask questions that other people maybe aren't allowed to ask. And maybe you can think a little bit more laterally about it. And so I was looking at it and I was doing the research. I read a bunch of papers, I think 15 or 17 different papers, trying to understand mini grids in Africa. And what it came down to was that it's not a good investment. It's just not a good investment. You know, so like, why should I go invest in this? And the reason why it's not a good investment is you say, well, you know, like I'm going to go sink $1 million, $2 million into building a site in this rural area. And I'm going to expect that there'll be a 30-year return on investment, right? So over 30 years, I'm going to get enough users of this electricity in these communities that surround this energy site that I will get paid back. The truth is that they never do, right? They I'm sure somebody has. There's very few sites, let's say, that have ever been profitable as mini grids. And so why would you put your money into that? Why would you invest into that if you know you're not going to get a good investment, where you could go put your money somewhere else and you know you will get a solid investment? So what happens is that real investors don't actually pay too much attention to mini grids in Africa. So what instead happens is that you get these concessionary financing organizations coming in, and these concessionary financing organizations are your African Development Bank, your European Development Banks, your USAIDs, your Rockefellers, your GAPs, groups like that. And they look at capital differently. And they, you know, sometimes their money comes with strings attached, but they're slow and they don't necessarily give you everything that you need right away. So what happens is that finally somebody will get some financing. There's this willful delusion pushed by the energy developer that they're going to somehow get this many users and this much uptake of their energy in this amount of time. And there's a willful delusion also by the people putting money into them that yes, they will do so, when there's no history that has ever happened. And so they get this This is crazy. So finally they get some money. So it takes them 5 years to get money and build their site. And then they go to work and they get 30% users after 5 to 10 years. In fact, we've seen a site that's 15 years old that has a 30% uptake. And of course they can't be profitable. So that's actually the problem. And why is that a problem? Because you don't make enough money to operate your own mini grid then. You can't actually pay your staff, your line workers, to go out there and fix things. You can't buy new meters to put into people's homes. Like, there's all these things that come about that are just don't make sense for mini grids until Bitcoin mining comes along, right? Bitcoin mining comes along and all of a sudden we find that stranded energy and we just go plug in and you go from 36% usage to 100% overnight, like literally overnight. And you start getting paid daily by that instead of hoping that you get paid every month or every 2 months by whichever customer you have. So that all led us, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot here, Jesse, but that all led us to this thinking about, well, you know, why is nobody bundling these two things together to build new energy? Why is Bitcoin mining and energy development not linked from the very beginning and built out? We've started running models on it. We're like, you can get a 5 to 7 year return on investment by just bundling energy and Bitcoin mining together instead of just doing energy by itself. And the Bitcoin mining reduces your risk on the front end of the first 5 to 7 years by giving you good returns. And even if you don't know where Bitcoin mining is going to go after that, it doesn't matter because you're also equity owners now in the energy, and the energy will always be used here because there's a pent up demand for it. So we think that there's this perfect storm where you can bundle the two and really push electrification across the continent.
Look, this is why I bugged you for so many months and pinged you every week to start working together, because I come.
I know, listen, I wasn't every week, but okay.
I mean, it felt like every week. And I come from that world. I operated, right. I was busy operating, you know, 20 odd solar power plants in West Africa and Mali on a Saturday morning, batteries fully charged, nobody's awake. What do we do with the stranded power? You know, you come to a site, you do all kinds of surveys, you send people. At the end of the day, 25% of the people that you originally signed up show up and pay you. Folks don't have money to buy grid connections, so now you need to donate those as well. All of a sudden, you are a microfinance institute, and it does not work. And this whole industry, and that's something I want to get into as well, is addicted to development aid, because these currencies of these countries where these things happen have been devastated already so far that there is barely no room to grow organically out of that situation, right? And as an operator coming from abroad saying, hey, we will operate renewable energy mini grids as a distributor, as a producer, as a utility, is not possible because you don't have bankable customers, right? And along comes this industry that now says, hey, you know, and this is again another clash, because the development aid industry, the energy industry, is very conservative, and along we come and say, hey, how about we use the energy all the time and we do Bitcoin mining? And they point at the door because it's going to say, hey, Bitcoin mining is not a bankable customer because we don't understand it. And now you add to that, halvening is coming down, right? This continuous push for efficiency as the reward for Bitcoin mining sort of drops in Bitcoin terms. And that's going to push Bitcoin mining out to the fringes, exactly to where you are operating already, right? Free power, revenue splits, online all the time. What if Bitcoin mining companies come along and say, hey, how about we work this operator and give them, I don't know, the 3 million for a 5 megawatt site or 3 million for a 3 megawatt hydro dam that's going to last the next 30 years and it's going to guarantee us access to free power for at least 50% of the time. And if it grows, right, we become an energy producer, we sell power at $18-$22 per kilowatt hour and we move the machines elsewhere. You've heard me talk about, you know, the decentralized nature, the decentralized future of energy generation in Africa, precisely because of what you just said. And I lost you a little bit, so I don't know how much of what you already said I am repeating. The question, though, Eric, is how do we get to how does gridless grow? How do you keep convincing operators to take a revenue split, to have exposure to Bitcoin itself? And how do you maybe develop an understanding within these development aid structures, the World Bank, the GIZ, the AFDB, all of these UK aid, US aid, all of these funders that give money to energy infrastructure and energy development in Africa? How do you convince them to, give them to adopt Bitcoin mining?
So, as gridless was being built out, and we were talking to people as we're trying to get going, there isn't a lot of people who were believing in that Bitcoin mining could be run at small off-grid mini grids across Africa, right? And so we had to kind of go out and build it first, and then people saw it, and then they believed in it, and then they started financing it. And I think the same thing happens here, which is if you want to see people change their paradigm of how energy can be developed, then you have to build it first. So we've been talking to these same guys that you've known for years, and they just can't get their head around it. And they're not going to change quickly anyway. They're not a fast moving industry. They're not going to change quickly. So we think the way to do this is to show instead. So we're starting with two sites, maybe three, that we're going to actually finance and build ourselves over the next, 18 to 24 months, because it takes that long to do this, in Kenya and Malawi, where, one site is, almost 2 megawatts in Malawi. Another site is half a megawatt here in Kenya. And there's a third potential site that's a little bit larger than that in Kenya as well. And I think that what we need to do is just go out there and find investors who can get on board with this model, set up some, special purpose vehicles for that purpose, and allow them to invest, and we build this ourselves. And so we already have a lot of interest. We have really good investors currently inside of gridless, so we're very fortunate. And some of them are going to take a key position in making sure that this can happen. But I think that's how you do it. You have to show, hey, there is a new model and this is how it works. And then that activates the other capital, right? Because they see, okay, I don't have to risk my capital to prove that this works. It's already been proven by somebody else's capital. And anyway, that's where I think the way forward lies.
Is there a world, Eric, in which, over the next 10, 20 years, Bitcoin miners are going to do more for renewable energy build out in Africa than, those institutions are doing right now?
Well, I think we're so used to the world that you saw when you were in the energy world here in Africa for the last, 3 to 5 decades, that we think that's normal, right? Where concessionary financing, development aid is really the driver of investment into energy. And the truth is that's a bastardization of what actually should be going on, which is these are good businesses to build. Investors, ordinary investors, should be able to come in, invest in new energy being built out, and get solid returns on that investment. So that's what Bitcoin mining brings to the table that didn't exist before, is the ability to come in, be a long-term owner of energy, which is always a good thing. There's always a good return on energy over time if you can get the right population on it. But the Bitcoin mining allows you to fill that gap between the time where you build and the time where you have a bigger uptake or a larger uptake of that energy. And so I think it will become the norm that this model exists. This gridless model that we've been experimenting with over the last year and a half, 2 years, is really just the beginnings of, I think, what will be a revolution in energy across Africa.
Eric, talk to me about Gamma. What is Gamma? What is Gamma trying to do? And how does it sort of feed into what you just said?
So Gamma is the Green Africa Mining Alliance. One of the second mission of gridless, first mission is to help push electrification further to the edges in Africa. The other mission, though, the second part, is that we help decentralize the Bitcoin network to put hash rate in parts of the world that it doesn't exist already. And so, just by existing and doing that in, three different countries in Africa, we've already proven that you can do this, and you can do it in a financially viable way. But that's not enough for us, because we know that there's a lot more energy out there, and there's stranded energy that can use the same gridless model. and that there's other people who can build businesses in places that we could never be. In fact, there's so much of this energy that we could never even address it ourselves. So part of our mission the whole time, and why we're one of the founding members of Gamma, was to make sure that there's others who are out there in mining and have access to capital, equipment, operational know-how that we have, and you know, that we learn from others in Gamma as well. And also to just open source this model, right? So that other people can do it. So whether that means open sourcing the hardware designs for our Bitcoin mining containers that were designed here in Nairobi, or it means, you know, sharing our where we buy our miners from, and going and working with the other Gamma members to show how we do repairs and learning from others on how they do their repairs and things like that. That's all part of Gamma, right? Is this idea of making sure that there's more miners across Africa, not just one mining company that's doing everything. Because we don't want to be the, you know, the one big company in Africa that does all the mining. We think we want to have a decent sized footprint, sure, but we need to make sure that there's a lot of others who are doing the same thing. So that's what drives us as Gridless in the whole Gamma space, in that Gamma association. And I'm looking forward to what's going on in, you know, with our partners in Zambia. There's some other miners there. What the guys are doing in Nigeria, I think, is fantastic. We're seeing real growth there by them. Of course, Ethiopia is exploding. We're seeing what Sebastian and his team at Big Block are doing in Congo and how that's expanding. And they're moving into another West African country this year. Like, all this kind of stuff is super exciting. And we're always trying to get more miners in, which is where you and I have been working together, right? On the seed program. The Gamma seed program is a program where we get very low cost older miners from larger companies. Usually these are have to be a certain efficiency. So like say S19s or M30s. And we have people across Africa who want to get into mining and maybe don't have the capital yet to get started, where we say, listen, you pay for the shipping of these miners to you, and we'll get, you know, up to maybe five miners to you to use on whatever energy source you have. We go through a vetting process to make sure they're legitimate guys who actually have access to energy. And then we get them miners. And the seed program is about seeding ASICs with potentially new miners across Africa so that there's more miners across the continent. And hopefully some of those will be like, you know, the guys at Trojan Mining in Nigeria, who started off with just two miners of their own and now are running almost a megawatt. Right? Like, that's the kind of thing we need to see more of if we want to have the true decentralization in mining happening across the whole network.
Yeah. And I already see potential for people who could reach that, you know, to start out maybe with 5 cents on the grid at their homes, learn how this works. We educate them on hash price, how to connect the machines in their local network and all of that stuff. And then maybe they take it to the hydrodam in the next site over. Eric, why, before we close up shop here, why do you think it is that I've never seen as much collaboration in a space that's as competitive as Bitcoin mining? It's so weird to me. You have, on the one hand, you have this highly competitive space in Bitcoin mining that's literally pure free market competition all over the world all the time. But then you get things like Gamma, where people actually work together. They share their ideas around repairs, new sites, capital, and all of that stuff. What do you think that is?
I mean, I'm not sure beyond the fact that, you know, if people choose to work together and choose to do things, you know, in a small, loose network, that you can actually go a lot further. Right? So trust has to be built. But I've seen it happen. Like I was at the Nashville Energy and Mining Summit in January, and, you know, there's miners coming from all over the US and some global for that. And, you know, people are very open and trying to help each other. So it's not just Gamma here in Africa. I see that happening in other parts of the world too. You know, not everybody is that way in the whole industry, obviously, but I think when you're dealing with, you know, small to medium sized miners, and even some of the larger ones, they are open to sharing and learning and doing things. You know, not everybody is competition to everybody else. So, you know, you can do those kind of things.
I have a hard time seeing Bitmain open sourcing their ASIC hardware, but you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll I agree. You know, and you know what's going to happen is that the market will decide on what they want, right? And if somebody has, you know, is well backed financially, has a good product and good support and good efficiency, all the normal things, and is open source or is, you know, more flexible, helping people get access to APIs, you know, they might become more relevant than Bitmain.
Yeah. Eric, I could make this a 3-hour show easily. Both of our time is restricted. I'll have to have you back. I have two more questions. First question is, did I ask you or did I not ask you anything that you wish I had?
No, I'm sure we could talk for a lot more. So no, but I think there's a lot of conversation topics in this whole space. So I'm sure we can talk again.
Second question, does Bitcoin use enough energy or not?
No, we need more energy to be used by Bitcoin to make the network more secure, make Bitcoin more secure. And number two, we need humans to use more energy. You know, yes, let's make things more efficient as we go along, whether it's your light bulbs or your miners, but like we need more energy and not less. And this idea that less energy is somehow the answer to things is I think, not how humanity has ever worked. And so it will not be the future. More energy for more people is actually the future.
Eric, tell people where they can find you and Gridless and how to get in touch. And yeah, tell them what you want to leave them with.
Sure. So you can find us on Twitter at Gridless Compute, also online at gridlesscompute.com. And then I'm White African on Twitter.
All right, guys. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. I know I did. Barely looked at my notes over here and the hour flew past. Eric, thank you very much for your valuable time. I'll see you soon again. If you have any questions or comments, please leave them down below. Leave a like and a subscription on the video. Swan will appreciate it and I will as well. I'll see you next Sunday again for some more mining talk. I'm not sure who that's going to be with, as per usual, but I'll see you there. That's for sure. All right. Have a good day. Thank you. Bye-bye.